Talking with Forgotten Machines at VCF Midwest 2023. Walking through the hallway. Here we go.
Sure. Good.
No.
CTOS
system.
Had those in the airport, huh? Blown away.
What's that?
Blown away.
P-Mail? You know P-Mail is? Were you in the Air Force?
No.
Oh. Precision measurement equipment.
Is that the
calibration and repair of test equipment.
I was not seeing they got two machines there. It's the same thing. Snacks at the top, drinks at the bottom.
Well, yeah. 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 I bet that opened up a lot of opportunities.
Monster Energy
later on, or no?
When I got out, I went into their calibration lab, one of their calibration labs. But then it was... the dot-com boom was happening, and computing was hobby. And a friend of mine convinced me to go interview for doing, this is back in the 90s, doing help desk. And I'm like, well, I'm not an IT guy. I haven't been in school for IT. And like, I think you'd be okay. And I went and did that, and they hired me, and my IT career started, and now I'm a network engineer. That's what I do. So, and I do repair these things to keep my electronics go up. So I do a lot of repair.
Interesting. Yeah, that help desk amazingly can lead to higher things, huh?
Yep, it sure can.
Right? It's entry level, but it's still.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So and that was like that was in the 90s.
So network engineer, is that something that traditionally you need an IT degree?
No, my degree is in electronics. And now, of course, I started and worked my way up through the dot-com era, and the... Everything's grown so fast in IT that there was a lot of demand for people that could do certain jobs. And then, of course, I got to know enough people in where I live to where I could easily get a job just by networking with people, So
what do you do with Retro now?
I collect stuff and I repair stuff, but 8-bit. Stuff in the 70s, 80s, mostly. I don't get into home stuff, really. That's what I get into. I don't really get into... PCs and like IBM Windows. I don't care about that stuff. Okay.
Commodore or
yes.
Atari?
Mainly Commodore.
Commodore? Okay.
Yeah.
Repair?
I do repairs.
Okay.
So yeah, I do a lot of Commodore repairs actually.
So I've got a Commodore 64. It doesn't turn on.
Okay.
So I give it to you. You do some diagnostics on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. You have it here?
I don't. I should have on it with.
You said you have it? Yeah.
But yeah, I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have some test equipment, but I didn't bring everything.
But I do have a 1541 drive now that's stuck in the main room. I'm trying to load Star Wars on it, and it's blinking red.
Okay.
And now it's blinking green.
Okay.
And now it's now it shows a menu, and it's still stuck on the load sequence for Star Wars.
Okay.
If you could look at it tomorrow.
Yeah, I'd be happy to
do
it.
Do drives? Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So, and it says, it's got the original sticker, it says refurbished by Commodore.
Oh, wow.
So it's an early, I bet it was early 80s,
yeah.
Or mid 80s,
yeah.
Where they did it, because it's got the original sticker.
Okay, wow. So you said it loads partially?
Loads partially, but the game's not loading. The screen's loading. The directory loads.
Yeah.
But you can't type it because it's now the green light's going. Something's happening.
Are you loading?
I'm loading Star Wars, and you know what?
Jerry Olson.
Yeah. She signed my Commodores.
That's Taylor and Amy, too.
But you know what's interesting? I started it before we went to dinner tonight at Aurelio's.
Uh-huh.
And when I came back, it was at this point.
Okay.
So it was loading for like 10 minutes before I left.
Okay.
It kept. And then the red light would blink.
Yeah. Either it could be dirty head or misalignment, but if it looks partially, it's probably dirty head. Because usually if it's misaligned, none of it will load.
Yeah. Did you bring your tools with? I didn't bring everything. I just brought a multimeter, soldering stuff, and I do have a chip tester. So if the chip can be, if the chips can be, you know, if they're socketed already, I can test the chips.
Okay.
I mean, I can test all the Commodore chips, but I don't know how many are socketed. A lot of times they're not socketed. So not all of them are socketed, you know.
Oh.
So yeah, I'm pretty limited on what I can test right now. I wouldn't plan on. I just brought stuff just in case. Like, basically, like, sometimes I'll be walking through and somebody will be like, hey, somebody got a soldering iron? Hey, somebody got a multimeter? And I'll, like, there you go. You know, I'll tab it on my backpack. So, and things like that. So, I just never know. I'd bring stuff, like, I'm not going to bring my oscilloscope and, you know, my whole soldering station and all that kind of stuff. And all my extra parts that I have. I got a stock of a lot of parts and stuff, especially for Commodore stuff. So.
Yeah, it's hard to bring that stuff.
Yeah. Right.
What are these guys about? It seems like they're like part of some group, or
no, he's just got his this guy. He goes to a bunch of the shows and.
But what does he do with this?
What's that?
He got shirts. What does that mean?
Oh, no, that's his Forgotten Machine shirt. That's his.
Well, what is it?
I think he's got it. Is that your website? Like, or is that your website or what, YouTube channel?
Yeah, yeah, we're curious about what your is.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to a bunch of shows.
Yeah.
So
Hi,
I'm Nico.
Nico, I'm AJ.
Hi, AJ.
Pleasure to meet you.
Hi, pleasure to meet you.
Welcome to the table of machines that you've never seen.
Oh, well,
or if you have seen them, it's unusual.
Well, and I'll talk to you about this. Yes, I had those in the Air Force, the CTOS machines.
Yes. Yeah. But they're both CTOS machines.
Right, that
you
one.
Had this.
That's the one.
This.
Yeah,
this
I had
is
this
one,
one
of the, our least forgotten.
Okay, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, what's your society about, your Forgotten Machines?
Vintage computers from the 70s, pretty much, that mostly were used for for business of some kind, and so almost none survive, and in some cases none survive.
Yeah.
Oh, hi. Yeah. What a bunch of nerds.
that we guilty. That's guilty as charged, sir.
Supposed to be extra nerds and having a drink.
The bourbon left.
Oh, there we
the
go.
The bourbon went to bed.
No. Okay.
If you have more of any type of.
Okay, so you have a drink.
Oh yes. Is anyone? Can
this
I tip anyone for more?
This kind of reminds me of like Wonder Woman sets.
No sets.
They've got these
Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman. Yeah. I barely remember that. Machines.
Show.
They've got these machines.
Okay.
That are just like futuristic, you know, and
that's blinky light futuristic.
Yeah.
As I rub your chest right there.
So what?
In a very creepy.
Tell
sort of
me
way.
More about Forgotten Machines. You said machines that are gone, forgotten.
Exactly.
Where did they go?
Well, the general populace just doesn't know about them, and usually even the most people here don't know about them, because if you walk by my table and you say I've never seen any of these before, those are the Forgotten Machines. Because society as a whole has completely forgotten them. Obviously they existed. Here they are.
Like Data General, the number 3 computer company for 15 years.
Yeah.
Sometimes number 2.
Yeah.
But number 3 generally. And no one cares.
DEC's not forgotten.
DEC is not forgotten.
DEC is not forgotten.
IBM is not forgotten.
Right. But Data General, yes.
Data General.
And its cloners, Digital Computer Controls, absolutely forgotten.
Well, to most people. But yeah, mostly forgotten. Yeah. Yes. Point four.
Point four. Do you know I have 2.4 racks in my kitchen?
Okay.
Are you surprised? You
no.
should say no.
No. Okay, no. I found a point
stuff.
Four on
like
the way.
You got more stuff in there, right?
I have 3 more tables. This is the 4th.
About 10 years ago in Hicksville, Indiana, a surplus shop had a point four.
Now describe it. Describe this point four to me.
Was it? I don't know.
Was it a rack?
It was built.
See, it's better to compute. Like Kraftwerk said, it's more fun to compute.
Yeah.
You know, like Kraftwerk at all?
Who?
Kraftwerk.
I never heard
German.
Of
German?
No, I don't know. That
Pioneers,
one.
Yeah.
And
they have a lot of imagery of computers in their music.
Ah, okay.
Oh, yeah, it's
the first person
it's a band. Oh, okay.
No,
I haven't heard of it.
Yeah.
For data tapes that I have. And did you know?
Did I know?
Did you know?
I didn't know what.
So, Forgotten Machines.
So you know of this television show, I would imagine.
What is that?
What's that?
Knight Rider?
Yeah.
Holy cow. Yeah, I know about that. Okay, that's right. Because you're the Knight Rider historian.
Correct.
Are you?
And, oh, yeah. And did you know that the semi that was used as the mobile command center in the show,
right.
We actually have we have found, acquired, and are restoring. Did you know that?
Okay. Really? I did not know that.
Okay, well, now you do. And the way we did it was by reverse engineering the .4. Iris operating system and me using the universal QIC tape reader to read the data tapes for a .4 system, and it turns out that the VIN of that semi was on those tapes.
Excellent.
And of course we knew VINs of something were on those tapes, which is why we worked hard to get those tapes. And we didn't find VINs of Knight Rider cars, the Trans Ams, but we did find VINs for the semi, so we said, well, we're going to have to go after the semi then.
Is the Trans Am known to exist?
Well, we by us. We own two of them.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, that's right. There probably would be several.
There's
of them.
Five of the original survive, confirmed by us. We own two. We own two of the five. There is one that went MIA. We cannot confirm its demise.
Wait, did you not understand that?
Only one. Only one.
Are they on display to the public or what?
Yes, one of ours is at the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles, on loan from us.
Oh,
yes. Good night, guys. Oh, wait, that was the whole party.
Yeah, I mean,
all right.
Mouse and I showed up for Guardian Machine.
Well, where did Mouse go? I didn't see him.
He went poof.
Oh, God.
Small little guy. He disappears.
You know, there's an episode of Knight Rider.
And Richard returns on cue. Yes, there is an episode of Knight Rider.
There's an episode of Knight Rider where they steal Kit.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And they remove it.
Yes.
Right?
They did not appreciate what I was singing.
Find it and plant it back.
So it sounds like you're referring to the second season episode, Soul Survivor.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so it's stolen by a 17-year-old kid by the name of Randy, who works for Adrian Margot, this vixen mistress who seduced him into doing all of these techie things and hacking the Night 2000. And I know the whole episode.
I'm glad. When I found one night, I flipped through the channel, and they had a marathon of Knight Rider like every hour.
I would now that's a good night.
And it was on till like 5 a.m. At 3 a.m. I just kind of fell asleep. It was great. Love it. Forgotten Machines.
Does
that also include forgotten software?
Not everything.
Software kind of like Friends.
Yeah. But I have a tendency to start with the hardware. And so if it's the software, if it's the operating system and then software for said forgotten machines where the hardware is forgotten, that's usually the right thing. So if it's some forgotten PC program, I'm going to leave that to LGR. Let LGR's Oddware handle that. That's LGR's Oddware segment. And so also, I don't like to cover stuff that's covered by other YouTubers. Which is fine. I mean, I do on occasion, but I don't generally like to because then it's not forgotten. People know. Especially all the viewers.
Would you ever go on somebody else's show podcast to be interviewed?
I have many times.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd like to interview you if you don't mind.
Would I not mind. I'd be honored. I don't even know your channel. What is your channel?
Oh, Man Behind the Machine.
YouTube channel.
Only audio.
Oh, okay, so it's only audio.
Yeah.
But still.
But, yeah.
I'd be honored. Okay, I'd absolutely be honored.
Thank you. I was just interested because I came by and I saw the logo. And I thought, who are these forgotten machine guys?
Yeah, it's Convergent.
What society are they a part of?
Convergent, the mini frame and the mighty frame. And
what's on the bottom? Is that a mini
frame? That's an NGEN. NGEN.
I thought NGEN was a fucking biomedical company.
It is, I'm sure. Everything is an effing biomedical company. Everything. I'm sure you're right. But it also happens to be...
I'm thinking Amgen. I'm sorry. AMGE.
Oh, no, that's the Wonder Drug.
Well, that's the pharmaceutical company.
Very good. You're right.
Sorry.
Do you acquire, are you looking for these, or do people come to you and say,
both.
By the way, I've got this, and do you want to adopt it?
I tried to buy some more beer at Walmart.
Yes, but more often than not.
There's a hell of a lot down the hall.
More often than not.
Now the party's kind of
moved over there.
Where was I? More often than not, I will pick a machine, I'll hunt for it, when I find it, then that becomes a feature.
And
little clue. They have a tendency to be used as props in Knight Rider. So a lot of the machines either were used as props as Knight Rider or have some tangential connection to the investigation that I've done from a machine used in Knight Rider.
I don't think we can.
The Help Convergent Technologies thing wasn't used in Knight Rider, but the Convergent Technologies Mighty Frame is actually owned by the Vista Group, and the Vista Group procured all the Transams and the Semi for the show. And it was the Convergent Technologies Mighty Frame that I started with to try to get the data off of because we wanted the VINs. But there was nothing on the internet. It was a forgotten machine. So I had to teach myself how to reverse engineer it enough to get it to run and to get the data off of it.
What's your background? Do you have any background in
some
computers?
Some tech? But I have no college degree. I did not have a computer science degree. I don't have an engineering degree.
Self-taught. Self-taught. But you have a passion for it.
Can you tell?
Yeah. I can tell.
Thank you.
What was your first computer?
It was a Commodore 64.
Okay.
It was almost a Coco.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay. My Commodore 64 is on display in the main room.
A lot of people's Commodore 64.
I bet. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
I love that.
That's awesome. Yeah. I like you even more now that you had a Commodore.
Yeah. My first computer was a Commodore. It was almost a Coco. And actually, for some strange reason.
Why do you say almost a Coco?
Because the day that Dad decided to get us a computer, we were at the Museum of Science and Industry in Des Moines, Iowa. And I spent half of the day on the computer that they had for their people, you know, for their museum attendees or, you know, to play with. And it was a Coco.
Coco one or two?
It was a one. And my dad took a picture of me sitting at it so I could actually identify, you know, from the badges on it, which Coco it is. And I also know the date, so that, you know, that corresponds with that. But on the way home, Dad went to Radio Shack and priced Cocos. And decided he wasn't going to make it. He almost wrote a check right then and there. And then he said, nah, let me do some more investigation. 3 days later, he came home with a Commodore 64. So it was almost a Coco.
Almost a Coco.
Almost a Coco.
Okay,
but
I like that.
I don't know that I have any regrets for that because, you know, the Commodore, Dad was right. For the money, the Commodore was more capable for what we wanted to do. We could do more with it. So I think for a day or two I was disappointed that it wasn't the same machine I played with at the Museum of Science and Industry, but I quickly got over that.
You quickly, right?
Quickly got over that.
Yeah.
Of course, it has Ed.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Your dad sounded like a smart guy.
He was a mechanical engineer.
So smart.
So he actually learned how to use it. And, you know, it could do more than his HP calculator from 1975. Sure. So, to him, that was a big deal. If it could do more than his HP calculator.
Yeah.
And now he didn't need
and
a slide rule anymore.
At this time, are you watching Knight Rider?
Oh, absolutely.
As you're on your Commodore 64?
At the exact time, I'm watching Knight Rider.
Right? Yeah.
Because it's the year is 1982, right? Uh-huh. And 1983, and the first season of Knight Rider is 82 and 83. 80, yeah. You know, 82 to 86 was the run of Knight Rider.
And you know what? I kind of tell the newer generation is like, there was a time, you might not know this, but there was a time when if you wanted to see a program, you had to actually go in the house and sit and watch it.
At the time it was on. Yeah.
This, and I thought about this yesterday about on demand, this whole fixation with on demand.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, as I heard this yesterday, I'm like, to the 80s sensibility, on demand wasn't in our vocabulary, right?
It didn't exist.
It may be in some other app,
okay,
you know.
Okay, so you could go get McDonald's on demand, but we didn't call
that's
it
called
that.
Fast food.
It was called fast food, but it's that concept.
Yeah, or
but then
Seinfeld, not fast food, but food, good food made quickly. Yeah, right. Yeah. But anyways,
fast food. That was the closest concept we had.
Yeah. So you get your 64, and how long does that 64 fixation last until the new shiny object comes around?
Or no?
There was no new shiny object.
No?
So, when Dad was going to... By the way, we're actually recording now, right?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. I love this. I didn't even realize this. Yeah. I didn't even realize you had started the interview, and I'm so glad.
Okay, thank you.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, and yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, we're rolling.
Please.
And I will delete any personal information. So,
everything I just shared is fine, including that part.
Wonderful.
where I just realized we just started. That's just fine.
Sometimes it's natural is best, because then people get subconscious when they think you're recording.
Well, I don't think I will be. All right. So the question is, what was the next machine?
Yeah, next machine.
So you know, in 85, Dad said, well, you know, the Commodore 128 is coming out, so maybe we should get a Commodore 128. And I think he almost did, but at this point, you know, where he works as an engineer, he has you know, an IBM compatible. It's the AT&T 6300, right? So that's made by Olivetti in Italy. But it's a PC compatible in 1985.
I had an Olivetti typewriter, yeah.
Yeah, but it's the AT&T Unix, not the Unix PC. That's a different thing entirely. The 6300, you know, runs DOS. And so in 85, he made the decision to say, well, all right, this is what I use. You know, and what he was trying to do was just trying to say, where is the future going? I'm in the industry. This is what we're being provided. I think I probably need to be using this at home and have my son use this at home as well. So now I have a PC. And so it's different, right? This DOS thing and autoexec.bat and all of this kind of stuff. And it wasn't quite as fun, and there were zero games, at least available to me.
This was an IBM that he got, or a clone?
No, this was an AT&T 6300. And that is an IBM compatible PC.
Yeah, I remember the AT&T.
Right. And so it runs whatever DOS AT&T license to put on that thing, right? And is it a 386 or a 286?
Yeah.
I think it's a 386.
You know what I noticed that I find interesting is around 1986, 1987, if you look at the computer magazines, right?
Mm-hmm.
I find it very fascinating that there's a specific one in a compute magazine, like I think it's 87, December or something, and you see like the event horizon, right, of the Earth and the you know, the event horizon.
Okay, sure,
where,
yeah.
You know, the sun's like shining over that,
yeah,
and the Intel chips coming over. And when I've got this magazine cover, and if you look it up, it's just so prophetic and telling, because you see the progression of computers, right, from the Atari to the Commodore in general, with all the 8-bit systems, right, through the 80s, and then in about 87, Intel's literally telling us, they're telling us that they're taking over the Earth. Right?
Yes, that's what they're telling
us. The event horizon.
Are you going?
I'm sorry to cut you off here.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
It's been nice hanging out.
That image always burned in my mind. Intel is coming over the Earth. And their chips, like literally like a spaceship flying over saying, we're taking over, you guys.
Uh-huh.
You're done.
Uh-huh.
And then after 87, forget it. It's like Intel.
Yeah.
What happened? You know?
Well,
the 8-bit era was done.
And I wasn't conscious of this at the time. Right. Now, of course, I can look back at that, and that was you know, obvious where that was a fundamental shift. But quite frankly, I don't know that even now that I care. Or maybe that's why the Forgotten Machines, because I'm clearly and squarely focusing on an era where that's not the case. As a matter of fact, the first Forgotten Machine I worked on, I told you about this, right, was the Convergent Technologies Mighty Frame. Okay, so you weren't recording when I was telling you this, so it must have been somebody else. The Convergent Technologies Mighty Frame is the machine that the Vista Group had.
What year?
So the Mighty Frame, this one was manufactured in 87.
Yeah.
And I got my first clue that maybe this machine doesn't have the right data on it, because the chassis is stamped 1987 and the year's run for Knight Rider was 1982 to 1986. So already the dates don't match. Already. But you know, the Vista Group guys, who were still alive at the time, said, you know, we kept this on our computers, so we kept these records and we kept them on our computers, so you know, if they transfer those records over from whatever they had before 87, then that you know, they could be on there. So that's why I started with the Convergent Technologies Mighty Frame. Now, the reason I bring up the Mighty Frame is it is from 87, 88, 89, and it did not run an Intel chip. Motorola 68000.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, no Intel.
Amiga,
so,
same thing Amiga
right,
went
so,
with it, right?
So, right, but Amiga is kind of a business machine, but a lot of consumers had it. I can promise you not a single consumer had a Convergent Technologies Mighty Frame. Starting at a price tag of $25,000, $1987, I don't think so.
And what was the application mostly for?
Businesses. It was a. I think it supported up to 16 users, Unix-based.
Oh, okay, so
right?
Yeah, it was a workstation.
It's a workstation, right? It's RS-232 dumb terminal is the only way to communicate with it. Now, over serial. And so, you know, you have your master station, and then you have a bunch of other stations for login, and it's the Unix operating system. So, multi-user station, and it ran on the 68020.
Amazing.
So, from there, I realized that in order to learn about that, I had to find a less forgotten machine, which was the AT&T Unix PC, because there were people on the internet that knew about that. And if I learned about the Unix PC, which people said was like the mini frame, and the mini frame is the little cousin to the mighty frame, well, I better start with the Unix PC. So, I got all this 68010, 68020 experience. And that's kind of how I started with the Forgotten Machines thing. I didn't call it Forgotten Machines thing. I called it Mighty Frame because that's the machine I started with. But once I expanded and I realized it was more fun to do this, and of course this is why you're seeing Convergent Technologies machines here, because I realized that not only was the Mighty Frame a forgotten machine, the entire company is a forgotten company. The AT&T Unix PC is not quite forgotten. There's one here, right? And they show up at VCFs on a fairly regular basis. But not everyone knows that that was designed and manufactured by Convergent Technologies, and that it's an adaptation of their earlier machine, the Convergent Technologies MiniFrame. Not many people know that, yet it's true. So the MiniFrame, forgotten machine.
Who bought out Convergent Technologies?
Unisys, 1988 or 89, and phased it out. But by then, things were already moving to Intel-based chips, 386 machines
so
and up.
So Unisys saw an opportunity. They wanted to squash this competition.
I don't know if they wanted to squash it, but they did.
I know, but okay, maybe
They intended to or not.
Well, okay, that's fair enough. I'm not going to speculate. I just want to say that it sounds like when companies do such a thing, where they say, "We're going to buy you out. We're going to just level this place. You know, fire all the engineers." And we're going to kill the technology and just squash it.
I'm pretty sure that... I agree, but I'm pretty sure that wasn't their intention. But over a shorter period of time, of course, this was happened. But it was also the natural evolution of things, as you said. Intel took over the world. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
So they weren't building stuff with Intel chips. These have Intel chips, right? This is the 8086.
Yeah.
They both are. Actually, this is an 8086. This is an 8186.
Okay.
And but the reason I got interested in these mostly was because of this. When I did research on Convergent Technologies to try to learn about the Mighty Frame, the only machine that came up was their first machine. It was one of these, or an earlier version of one of these, called the IWS, which stands for the Integrated Workstation. This is the AWS, which stands for Advanced Workstation. The Integrated Workstation came out in 1979, and these were 81, 82. Right, and so then these came out in 83. But they still are pretty forgotten, especially that one. This one less so, because there are people here who have them. No one else here has these.
Interesting.
Yes.
And they're both monochrome green?
Monochrome green, right. There are later versions of this that are color.
Yeah.
Of course, because that was the evolution of things.
Disk operating, do you got an eighth inch? Yeah, right?
I'm sorry?
You have an eighth inch disk?
The doctor's back, but I'm leaving now.
Good night, doctor.
Good night, guys.
Right. Or 5 1/4, right? Yeah.
Well, here you see the 5 1/4 inch slot. This also would be, you said eight.
Yeah, did they ever do eight? Did they ever do 8 inch?
The IWS ran on 8 inch disks. The hard drive was 8 inch Winchester, I believe, and the floppy 8 inch Shugart. But the IWS had to put those below the desk in a tower because they're 8 inch. Here, this was revolutionary. The disks got small enough to 5 1/4, where they could actually put a floppy side by side with with a hard drive, and you can see those right here,
Yeah.
Floppy slot right here.
Yeah.
Right there. So there's your floppy slot and here's your hard drive. And so then the system boards are back here, whereas the original version, this whole thing was system boards, and then the 8-inch peripherals were on the floor in a tower.
Huh. And this is normally positioned upright vertically?
Yeah, they call it the lectern.
What's the reasoning behind that design?
Well, they, I don't know. Yeah, you got to take a picture of that.
Yeah, please, I need to. Well, you know, do you do any repairs on any of these?
Absolutely, I had to repair all of them.
Okay. What are you encountering mostly? Bone capacitors?
Power supply issues. I replaced very few capacitors.
Yeah?
Some wiring issues. These have held up fairly well. The CRT issues have been the biggest ones.
Okay.
So, and I'm sure that if I dive in and find the right capacitors, then, you know, we can straighten that out too. Especially if I hang out with Sark enough, if you know who he is, Mr. CRT. Mm. Ian.
I don't know him personally.
Well, I hope you get to. He's a good guy.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. He's here.
Yeah?
Yeah. In the big iron room like I am.
Yeah. So you're brave enough to delve into the circuits? And
absolutely.
And actually
I'm slow. All right. I don't have a high degree of acumen, but when I want to focus on it, when I have the time to focus on it, I just press through and I figure it out. And I've built a network of people smarter than me that I can call on and ask for help. And usually, if they don't give me direct help, they ask me a question that makes me figure out the answer myself.
Are you building a library of documentation?
Absolutely.
Manuals?
Every forgotten machine that I work on, I have a dedicated website to. And, of course, my YouTube channel, Forgotten Machines.
Oh, you're providing? Okay.
Yes. And in a lot of cases, you know, I come across manuals that aren't on BitSavers, that aren't on archive.org, and so I'm providing them to BitSavers and archive.org. But first on my website, because it takes time to get to those places as well.
I think it's important to preserve the history. I'm doing the same with Commodore. I have a Commodore preservation project.
Good.
And we're scanning. My motto is to scan every last floppy on Earth. Which I know.
Well, then you can appreciate my Flux imaging station there at the Forgotten Machines table as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check it out.
But, of course, I'm going to specialize in the less common media.
I'll get it set up so that way.
Yeah, exactly. That's great.
The less common media, like, you know, not
yeah,
everyone
like,
has
what's
one of
that?
These.
Forgotten well, this, Machine, that
this,
is new.
No, this is, well, but this is the Geswine, the David Geswine MFM reader and emulator. So this will image the flux off of an MFM hard drive with the ST506. So one of those is running in there instead of a physical hard drive. Of course, originally it was a physical spinning hard drive, and you'd be hearing it right now. It is kind of not quite as fun because you don't hear the whir and the spin and the clunk.
Who made this?
David Geswine.
So what if I...
Okay.
PDP8online.com/MFM. And you can see that somewhere on here. Runs on a BeagleBone Black. Brilliant design. Works very well. Developed it. And people started using it in 2005. I was an early adopter. Now there's a lot of them out there. There's probably at least a dozen of them in this room.
Does he have problems with finding the chips with this whole...
No. No. Not unless somebody does something stupid. Yes, it is.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Not unless somebody does something stupid. In which case, you're going to fry anything if you do something stupid.
No, I'm saying is, you know, with this whole shortage, chip shortage, has he had problems sourcing?
Oh, a little bit, but he's mostly, he builds it, it's open source, so source your own chips.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and if you can't source them, it's your problem.
Right, well.
But, you know, sometimes he does assemble them, and the price is reasonable, and I like his assembled ones, because...
Well, what do one of these run?
This looks like a...
150.
Yeah. Looks like a great project to do with the BeagleBone Pocket. You know, they have the BeagleBone Black in one chip now.
Sure. I'm sure it is.
I say with whiskey all over my
earth.
But that means you have whiskey and you're not sharing.
You are going to.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Digital Dark Age is the same damn thing. Everything is recorded in a media format that just gets abandoned. And all the information contained in that media format gets abandoned.
A guy by the name of George Hamstra has a website called digitaldarkages.net, and he publishes a lot of AT&T Unix PC 7300 software on there.
Right.
Password protected by request only, so he has to make sure you're a real person, just doesn't put it out there. So he's still respecting this copyright, which must be expired by now, but oh well. And he does that for a bunch of other machines in that venue.
I'll have to check that out.
But you said Digital Dark Ages, so it's digitaldarkages.net.
It's not a term I invented. Okay. It's one that I adopted.
And his real name, apparently, because he emails me with his real name, is George Hamster. Yeah.
All of this stuff, all of these older computers we work with, I grew up in the 8-bit era, and I had the misunderstanding that a computer that took a long time to start up sucked. So I like turning it on, you hear the beep, and the disk rattles, and it boots right up. But
you guys are great. You're dedicated to this.
Yeah.
Keep it up.
Yeah, they're having a good time.
Well,
now I lost my thread, but no,
you're going to have to learn. I mean, you're going to have to do a tutorial.
Technology is advancing so quickly that we just lose everything.
Because I think you've now learned more than me.
Sure, it's easy to learn.
And I don't want to sound sanctimonious, but it's on us to keep documentation going because nobody else is interested.
No, well, that's the forgotten machines because most of the machines that are on my table, I really get the feeling that if I didn't care about them, nobody would.
Yeah.
If I didn't make them known, nobody would.
I'm in a fan club. You're fucking
and
serious.
So that's why I've got, my YouTube channel is lagging, right? But my strategery.
I'm trying, man. I'm trying.
I find YouTubers that I like, and I hope they show up to VCFs, and then I give them my T-shirts, and then hope they wear them on their channel, and they do. Patriots Digital Basement's been doing it. Oh, he's such a great guy, though.
Oh, I love
him. He's such a great guy.
He's so sweet.
He really is.
A?
The Forgotten Machines.
That's it.
Forgotten Machines is his channel. Yeah.
My father-in-law invented the glass teletype, co-invented it.
Really?
No one's heard about it. He told me one day, he goes, no one knows about the glass teletype. He's co-founder.
But you're describing a terminal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so are we talking...
There's no point in doing it.
What terminal... version are we talking about? Was this an IBM product, a DEC product?
This was like part of Data 100.
It was called the glass teletype. It wasn't the first terminal. That was actually the name of it.
That was the name of it.
And what year did that come out?
Late 70s, early 80s. I have to really find. I have to pinpoint.
And so by then. By then, ADM already had, trademarked the dumb terminal as what is their model. Right? They actually called it the dumb terminal.
Dumb terminal.
Yeah, and that's Lear Siegler's ADM, ADM 3, Lear Siegler. So Lear Siegler,
I thought ADM 3 had cursor positioning and such.
That doesn't mean it's not dumb. It doesn't.
Technically, if you can move the cursor, it's not dumb.
That's an interesting distinction.
If you can send a terminal commands to do things other than print text to the screen. Now, this might be a semantic discussion on my part, but as I
think
understand
it is, but that's okay, I like that.
Key phrase, right? Here's a trademark, as I understand. No, as I understand it, if you can do something besides scroll text and put it on the screen, it's not dumb. There's smart terminals where you can send a command, you can clear the screen. And I'm going to use ANSI because it's one of the code sets I'm vaguely familiar with, ANSI and BT100. You can put the cursor in a particular area of the screen.
Like if that's some visual, it sounds like a character grid.
Yeah. And I'm not going to go so far as windowed scrolling. That's really advanced.
You guys being
but
in
that's
this.
All that's yeah. all smart.
Yeah.
You have dumb terminals where it was a typewriter, but it's actually printing to the CRT, right? That's a dumb terminal. If you can't reposition it like you could on a piece of paper, then it's dumb. If you can reposition the cursor, then it's smart. If you're actually running code on the terminal that is uploaded from the host, then you're getting into intelligence.
Interesting.
So I'd like to take that to another level.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess technically it
is dumb terminal is okay. So define for me the classic dumb terminal.
The classic dumb terminal is
like a model or something.
It would have to be pre-ADM3 because I don't know the ADM3 control set for sure. But as I understand it, you have the ability to position the cursor, clear the screen, do things like that.
Okay.
I would call that a smart terminal because you can send it commands.
Okay.
It can interpret them.
All right.
Yeah.
So you're making a distinction
and I'm
between
probably,
a dumb terminal and a smart terminal.
And I'm probably playing...
And there was a lot of advertisements in the mid to late 70s that I see in Datamation and study in Datamation.
Our terminals
are smart. Where they're talking about, smarter terminals.
Yeah. And ADM3s are a lot smarter than people
do. So here's a question then. Are we keeping...
No,
are we doing this?
Good. Been
Let's
at
do
this for a while.
I love this. I love this.
I love it too.
So, Here's a question. The terminal that we're, or the yeah, the terminal that we're talking about, dumb or smart,
yeah.
In order for it to be a terminal, does it need to use some kind of serial RS-232 protocol to communicate?
No, that's beyond the scope.
Beyond the scope
that's
of...
That's beyond the scope of this discussion. How you connect to your host computer is not what we're talking about.
Okay, but does it define whether it's a terminal or not? I actually wish to change the scope of the conversation.
A terminal is a device that you connect to a host either remotely or via a cable in a local work environment. A console is a device that is handled by the host directly. Like if you had a text buffer, if you had a text buffer in the host RAM, then you have a console. If you're working with a serial terminal, if you're working with what is the IBM Sirius terminals that work over TwinX? I mean, those are technically a network terminal, but they're still a terminal. And you have X terminals.
I see your point. Okay.
So it's where the separation is.
So there's a specific reason I wanted to go there.
Yeah.
And one of the key, you know, one of the machines that I take pride in on my forgotten machines table in the room is the Entrex Datascope. Now this is a terminal who's designed from 1970. Uses the same design that Entrex designed in 1970.
Okay.
It communicates with the Data General Nova, but it doesn't use serial at all. It uses Richard gave me the best definition of it I've ever heard. It addresses the memory, the host addresses the memory directly. And it communicates over Manchester, over twisted pairs, and there's a stop go signal. So there's seven wires. So it's very different than serial.
So it's parallel after a fashion.
It's, I suppose, but it seems to be very proprietary to that system.
Okay. Yeah.
Now they call that thing in their own documentation. They don't call it a terminal. They call it a key station.
Okay.
And so I have a scrolling text on that machine that says that it's not what you're looking at is not a terminal. It's called a key station. Well, that's what the company calls it.
Yeah, that sounds like branding. But go on.
But I wonder, is that a case to say this actually isn't a terminal, or is the definition of it they're trying to be a little bit fancier?
Right, because
remember, the year is 1970, and is terminal in the lexicon?
I don't have knowledge in that particular.
So this was marketed to companies who need to do data entry, like your utility companies, your phone companies, your gas companies, right? And any place that a lottery in France used them, all kinds of data entry things, and the data entry prior to that point, the data entry was entered into a mainframe, usually the most common IBM mainframame, the 37, whatever model IBM mainframe is the rage that year. But the way data gets in there prior to these kinds of systems are punch cards, and so you've got operators who are stereotyped, all women, because that's women's work, are sitting at IBM 029 punch card machines or compatible, and they're keying in the information that they see on book, on reams of paper, however they get it. And they're keying it in on a punch card. And, of course, it punches the card, sends it on, goes to the next one. But this addresses the issue of how do they know if they made a mistake and how do they correct the mistake. If they know they made a mistake, then they ditch the punch card and they start over again. But what if they don't know they fat-fingered something? And they don't catch it, and it gets sent in as bad data. Well, of course, this is the norm. Up until these kinds of systems came along, there was no expectation that those errors would be caught. So this system is supposedly, it's marketed to replace punch cards, and it's called key to disk. Its competitors were called key to tape. Because the information, is fed into a mainframe instead of punch cards, now is into a tape. But what this is doing is this is aggregating the data, using a familiar interface to the punch card operator that has an 029 style punch card keypad as an option, right? So the button layout is the same as the 029 key punch, which is different than a typewriter, significantly enough. Numbers are in different places, characters are in different places, so it matches that. So your key punch operators are now operating on this key station, and they call it a key station. And so It can show them what they're entering. You've got forms and fields that are designed by the administrator, and so the field can reject data. If you put an A in the zip code field, it can reject that. A punch card machine can't do that.
Right.
So, but they call these things a key station. But are they really a terminal?
That sounds like
Maybe it's a marketing ploy. Who knows?
Yeah, it could be.
But that's a good question.
A key station sounds like a brand. And I'm not against the, being aware of what it's called. Key station does sound like a brand, it sounds like an interactive terminal. But the thing that makes it gray is you were saying that the host directly accesses the memory on the machine.
Yeah, so in what we would understand is let's say a generic dumb terminal like an ADM3.
Okay.
Your expectation is that the communication protocol with the host is serial at a certain baud rate, 300, 2400, whatever. 9600, if it's screaming fast, oh my God, right? So you get the point. And this uses a very, very different proprietary thing. And even more fun, the terminal I have next to it, that we colloquially call the trapezoid, and if you look at it, you can see why, is an upgrade to the same system, and they completely changed the protocol again, and it still doesn't match anything. The worst thing is, there's zero documentation for that technicality. So we spent 14 months reverse engineering the boards. That was a lot of fun. We finally got text on the screen.
I did that as an aside and unrelated. I did that with an operating system for the C64. I was having trouble with the compiler and the operating system because I was a noob, and I did a typical noob compiler mistake. In the end, I ended up disassembling most of the operating system.
Nice.
That's
a good one.
So the thing.
Okay, now, if you can hear in the background, that is indeed one of our biological sentient drones. It is made with the heart and soul and also artichokes of cabbage and some other choice plant creatures, dare I say. We do not have the patents on that. That is Monsanto. Right now, there's a bidding war between Monsanto, Apple, Microsoft, and of course, Bill Gates' subsidiaries, not to mention BlackRock, but that is a side note. Now, we are, of course, monitoring you for your own safety, because we do not like the idea of you being hacked or your trash being filtered through by extraterrestrial biological entities.